give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Colm, and my co-hosts, Mossy and Paul. This is episode 5 of season 2. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. This show does contain film spoilers, so if you have not yet seen the film, I would advise watching it first. It might help a little bit better. And now for today's show, I hope you enjoy. I suppose before you go any further, make sure you listen to episode 1, because that was Rocky 1, and this is Rocky 2. Welcome, Paul and Mossy.
Hello, Colm. How are you getting on?
Well, how are things, lads?
Good, good, good. And we are talking about Rocky number 2. And I suppose, look, the very first episode that we did was Rocky 1. So I suppose we'll be able to give a bit of a, has Mickey progressed or has Rocky progressed or been more coachable as we go on? We might get to them as we go on. But first of all, thoughts on the film?
I enjoyed it more than Rocky 1. Now, again, I've saw it, seen it so many times. I enjoyed it more than Rocky 1, but it's grand. Grand,
yeah. Yeah, look, I just think it's all right. I was under the impression that there was way more coaching in it and there wasn't as much as I'd hoped for. Like, I suppose a lot of it was about Rocky getting into sidetracked by fame for a lot of periods of the first 45 minutes or so of the film, and there wasn't as many good one-liners from Mickey either, so it was only okay.
Yeah, I think it was 46 minutes before Mickey came back in it. I know that he was, well, barred the opening scene, which was just a rehash of the first film, where I didn't realise Mickey was wearing such a lovely pink cardigan with Rocky in the back of it, but
yeah.
I don't know if either of you noticed that, but it was a fine piece of clothing. But Mickey, I suppose, still went to the wedding. He was, after Rocky had said he'd retired, there was only, I was 4 or 5 people at the wedding, and Mickey was one of them. So I suppose they were after the relationship from the first one had kind of carried through a small bit. And beyond that, as I said, we didn't see Mickey till about 46 minutes when Rocky went back and looked for his locker to get back boxing. And I suppose Mickey straight away tried to put him off. He was saying, like, he was showing him the finger with the eye where his vision was struggling. And from that, he was trying to tell him that, no, Rocky, this ain't for you. You're not, I suppose, not fit, and he could get seriously hurt. So what do you think of that? The way that he, I suppose, reintroduced himself to Mickey in boxing.
Well, I think the thing around the wedding, like, American weddings are different than the fact that he was there. Like, they're not as big as, we'll say, Irish weddings or whatever. The fact that he was there and he showed up out of courtesy rather than a real desire to be there, you know, and I suppose coaches and managers at times do that out of obligation or possibly sometimes at events. I think it's bad form when people have small weddings and don't invite many of their friends as well.
Or if they invite you and then they just say you're no longer invited, worse.
Oh, you get cut, like being dropped off the team. Yeah, look, that shit happens too.
And as you said earlier, Paul, you would prefer if you got a bullet to the head rather than 3 to the chest. We felt like we got about 10 or 12 to the chest.
Yeah, look, and Osher, you might make this cut. Cop on to yourself. That's just an aside anyway. Yeah,
but I suppose from the wedding, Mickey didn't even stay for the bit of grub afterwards. He went straight back to the gym. He had a couple of up-and-coming boxers. And, like, when Rocky did go back to him, like, Mickey kind of refused to coach him. He felt that Rocky wasn't in a safe place to go boxing. And he gave him the job. He gave him a job, in fairness, to kind of keep him on the straight and narrow, keep him busy. I suppose give him a few pounds.
Yeah, he'd a great way of saying that. He says, you got the heart, but you ain't got the tools. That was one of the better lines in the film, you know. And look, like, having, we talked about people being around setups previously that mightn't offer a whole lot, but Rocky's existence in the gym at that particular stage would have been pushing on a lot of the other people involved in the boxing club as well, you know.
Yeah, I think he said he was like God, or I don't know, is God the right word, but he said he was like a God to the rest of the fighters, and he couldn't go around picking up the spit buckets But he did kind of get use out of him in the gym. Or like, I remember one of my probably favorite comments of the whole the film was, he got Rocky over to teach one of the younger boxers how to snarl. And he says to your man, he said, snarl yeah. more. A good snarl can give you what the Bible calls a psychological edge. And Rocky had to come over and show him the snarl while he was punching. So I suppose Mickey was trying to keep him engaged some bit as much as anything else.
I think he knew that Rocky was on a, he's feeling sorry for himself and he was a bit down and just wanted to keep him ticking over, doing something.
Yeah. And I suppose we get into the real nitty gritty of it then when Mickey actually takes the bait that was set for him by Apollo. Then Apollo was trying to get at Rocky, but as I said, maybe Rocky's IQ level didn't allow him to react properly, but Mickey took the bait and said, right, let's go. And then they got back to training fully. And I suppose one of the things from early was Mickey said, we need to be prepared differently. And I suppose in the GA, that's something we'd see an awful lot is when teams play and they draw, how they change it up for the next day. And I don't know, was it Kilkenny Massey had a number of fellas who didn't play in the first All-Ireland final and would have started the second All-Ireland final and got men on the matches?
The best one, of course, wouldn't sit too well with Mossy is when Walter Walsh came on 2012 and scored 1-3 and was man of the match. Mm. And the following year, won't sit too well with you, Colm. Shane O'Donnell didn't play the first day, scored 3 goals the second day.
Correct.
Like got the hat trick. Both of them fellas didn't start the first day and were man of the match the second day, which is interesting. And you get that a lot of the times that it's only after, we'll say, the first match or the first fight in this instance that you really have a good understanding of what the opposition is about. And if you go back to the film Miracle, the idea of USA playing the USSR pre-tournament to get some sort of an idea of what they're like and how to expose weaknesses, etc., is something that's possibly there as well, you know.
But is it a case of, say, when you're looking back at them finds, you look at especially Cody in any replays, reading there today, just did a bit of research, I think he had 6 replays, he's won 5, and out of the 6 replays, he's an average of 3 changes per game, and that's not even positional changes. So like they weren't good enough to win that day. What do we have to do differently to win the next day? As you said, he brought in Walter Walsh. And if my memory serves me correct, he went on a Galway player who was one of the best players in the drawn match on Johnny Cohn. And he just, size-wise, he just exploited him. Like, he just did their research, basically, on what they have to do to improve their team. And it's happened a lot with Cody, like, so is it different when you're coming from being a favourite going into a replay rather than the underdog going into a replay? Like you're saying is, oh, the 15 is good enough to get a draw against Kilkenny, or 15 is good enough to get a draw against whoever. But they'll have to do the same job again. But if you're the favourite going in and say, I need something different, I trust my squad, what do I have to do to beat these guys? Did you go into different mindsets?
I do think there's possibly easier. There's always that perception that the favourite is getting the second chance or whatever. Right now I'm trying to rack my brain and think of, we'll say, a underdog who won the second time out, you know.
It was Dublin Dublin was the team to beat Kilkenny in the replay in 2013.
Remember Portlaoise, is it?
Down in Portlaoise, yeah. And they were the team who won, and their psyche is that now we've played against them, we know we can beat them. And they brought that into the next match. They did a lot of work with a sports psychologist that year, Tony Griffin.
Dublin Hurlers had a very good setup that year, that around that period. And I suppose it was just unfortunate that they didn't get the whole way there that year, because that was probably the most.
It was the lowest quality year. Probably.
I wouldn't say no. Quality,
it was the most unpredictable year. I wouldn't say it was the lowest quality year. It was the most unpredictable year.
I remember as in Galway has this big famine that year. Like, you're setting up, okay, beat Clare in a quarter final, we beat Limerick in a semi final, then possibly Cork in a final, and you're thinking that's a way to win an All Ireland. And like Kilkenny got beaten by Cork, that's their Sheffield got sent off in third. We were down there that day, Paul, are we?
Yeah, we were. Yeah,
Galway got beaten by Clare. That was one side of the draw. No,
and Cork got Dublin. Cork got Dublin.
Cork got Dublin. Yeah,
another sending off.
Another sending off. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose it was probably the one time when Tipperary and Kilkenny who were to the forefront from probably 2007 to that stage, neither of them got to semi final stage.
Yeah,
I suppose that's what opened it up for everybody.
Was it that year? Kilkenny played Tip in Nolan Park in an early round of the qualifier.
They played them in the league
the following.
Yeah,
and they played them in the league final down in Nolan Park that year. So it was just talking about getting up for games and down for games. Anyways, but just talking about go back to the film there. Like Mickey saw that to beat Apollo, he had to change his style. And one reason was to beat him, but also to protect his eye. He had to change from southpaw to orthodox. So he was minding them, but he also like bringing that element of surprise to the next match. That's what we're on about. The element of surprise that Cody brings to replays is what probably keeps the other team guessing, really.
Yeah, like, look, I suppose where can they get an edge? And, you know, as I said, if they've got the people that can identify that, and like you spoke with Walter Walsh and Johnny Cohen, but like Dublin are another side that have been extremely good in replays. But would they, like, have they made changes that have been, like, have some of the Man of Matches and All Ireland finals been players who weren't?
But, like, you think, like, just looking from the other side there, where Mayo made a couple of changes that didn't work out on our final day, like by changing the goalkeeper. Yeah. So it's like, who's to say they would have won or not won, but it doesn't always work. Like, you're not just saying that, oh, we get to a replay, we have to make changes. It's more like you have to identify what can we do differently to win the match, or is what we brought today good enough to win the next day? I think it's different for an underdog than a favorite. I think a favorite, they'll think, yeah, we're good enough to be here, we have to change things around maybe slightly and we'll get the better of them. Where the underdog more than likely has to come up with the same performance again and a little bit better.
Yeah, and like as Paul said, the favourites are usually kind of seen that, or it's the underdogs are usually seen that, right, you had your chance to beat them, and the favourites are going to win the next day out. So like there is adaptation that has to occur.
It is. I remember playing a championship match, geez, nearly 20 years ago at this stage, and we were playing a intermediate championship match, their top level. We were playing Cartoon Shamrocks and they would have been hot favourites. And we were point up going into injury time and they got a free about 60 yards out. Someone said something to the ref, was brought forward 20 metres, kicked over the bar, draw match. Played the replay the following week and they absolutely hammered us. You know, and we probably knew going in like we lost our chance, you know. We just, no matter what you say, it's like you probably know that, oh, that was our chance that day. What could we do, you know?
And I'm just thinking from my own experience then, we would have match, I think it was 2014-13 maybe. I would have been brought back to playing goals for a team in a East Cork junior A football final, and the keeper was going away on his honeymoon that week, so they got me back to playing goals. But I think it was 1-6 each after extra time. I think it was 1-3-6 at full time. It was a game for the purists, let's say.
Was in the middle of December or something.
I think it could have been October, definitely October, anyway, if not later. But I was actually dropped for the replay, keeper returned. I think we were after winning 2 in a row at that stage. But the team that we're playing, they actually went up. I think they were up 4 points at halftime after playing against the Gale Force winning the replay. And whatever happened in the second half, then it just fell apart for them. And our lads ended up winning comfortably enough in the end. But I suppose, had they got, you know, right, we're good enough to beat them. You know, this is, you know, we got to draw, we can beat them the next day. And when they got to halftime, and probably halftime came at the wrong time for them, like if we played 60 minutes straight through, they probably would have beaten us. But whatever happened, and whatever psychology that went on inside their own dressing room, probably hindered their second half performance, you know, whether they thought, no, oh yeah, we're going to win, we're ahead, we just got a strong breeze in the second half, let's use it. And did they lose it because of the psychology of it?
Like, Apollo lost the fight because of the psychology of it. Like, he went into the 15th round and he wanted to knock Rocky out, whereas all he had to do was dance around the ring and play very safe, and he was after winning, like, you know.
Yeah, he was his job. He was, he want, his ego got the better of him. His ego got the better of him. He wanted to prove a point that he was the bigger man, basically, than Rocky. He was the better fighter, but he just wanted to prove it to himself. Like, so, like winning isn't enough for some people in life. They won't have to have the perfect performance. Like, you're not always going to get that perfect performance. You have to sometimes just be happy with getting the W. It's like, do you ever kick a point or strike a point over the bar and you know it's wide, signaled anyways? Like, no. How would you feel about that? Colm, you would be disgusted about that.
Never happened to me.
No, I'd be kicking mine over the black spot now, Mossy, as well. So I'd be grand on that.
I don't do points, Mass.
Shandies, maybe.
Shandies. Oh, Lord.
No, one of the other things as well that I thought was actually really interesting in it as well, right, was I suppose it was before Adrian went into labour, was that Rocky's mind was not in the game. And Mickey said it to him a couple of times. You're too old to train a no good loser like you, is what Mickey ended up saying to him. And I suppose, like, as coaches, like, I know we talked about it before, Massey, about being conscious of the player's background, but is there a time when players actually need to just shut down from it? Like, when, I suppose we always say that GA in sport is a release, but is it always a release, or does that add to the stress that somebody might be under, like, let's say if it's work or home life or whatever? Like, is there something that we need to be conscious of?
I think it depends on the individual. Like, if someone's gone out playing a game in a bad place, like, it just can have detrimental values to himself, the player, and the team. I think a coach has to be wary of that. Is somebody in the right frame of mind to play a game? Now, who are we to judge says, oh, he's not in the right frame of mind? So, yeah, I suppose you have to just talk to the player and make sure that they're all right about things. Like, we've all played with a couple of headbangers, I'm sure. And
Mossy, like, there's even the element, like, that we don't always know what's going on in people's lives. I know of a case where there was a lad who was a county minor and he ended up having a child when he was a county minor and didn't say anything to the county minor management team and wasn't going well and ended up being dropped off it just prior to championship, you know. But like, I suppose that happened, whereas if that had been known, would he have been treated a little bit differently? Because, like, a lot of the lads in the county minor team are, like, completely insulated and don't have any stresses or problems to deal with, you know. Like, I thought it was admirable that Mickey was there for Rocky, we'll say, through the coma, through the premature birth. But when Adrian goes, win, like, Mickey's right, like, straight away, what are we waiting for? Like, forget about this shit, we're back onto the into the ring, you know.
Once Rocky got the okay from the family and from that side of things, he was happy to give his full commitment then. I think that's the same with a lot of people, though, isn't it?
I think it was actually 3 o'clock in the morning when Rocky phoned him at the church, or Mickey phoned Rocky at the church, and he said, if you want to blow it, I'm going to blow it with you. And he, you know, he stayed by his side in the church during that time, and he was inside in the hospital with him side by side. And in fairness, I suppose at Rocky's time of greatest need, Mickey was there on a personal level for him. And I know that's not always possible in GA when you could be dealing with a panel of, like, you could be dealing with, some of us could be dealing with panels of 35, others might have a panel of 19 or 20, like Jammy, which is grand. But I suppose, like, you could see how Rocky reacted to that as well. And I suppose, like, we talk about individuals, about trying to know the individuals. Like, Mickey knew that Rocky, like, he's not the smartest, but the smartest person in the world, and he probably did need that father figure support there on the side. But, like, it is important to get to know as much you can about players, really, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. But, like, again, it's a time thing as well. Like, it's, you build up a relationship over the years with people. Like, it's if you're just going to be a manager who's on the circuit or a trainer on the circuit, you're only there for a year or two, it's very hard to get to know these individuals.
And like, do you know, Mickey was there with him, as I said, and they went out, and Mickey did, as soon as he got to go ahead, he was right, come on, let's go. And Rocky did his montage. I know you're a fan of montages, Paul. How would that one rate?
Yeah, I suppose here, like, there was two different types of montages. There was the intense one with Mickey, and then there was the individual one of him running through Philadelphia and the kids going along with him. And like, as I was looking at it, it was very much, you know, them open days that inter-county setups to have prior to All Ireland Lions, where it's great that the kids get the opportunity to interact, you know, and that's what I was thinking of at that stage, you know. But montages, they were good. Not Rocky IV standard, but decent.
Yeah. I thought they were excellent. I thought they were really, really good. Like, it was just got you in the mood for the rest of the Rockies, to be honest with you. You want to turn on Rocky III and Rocky IV afterwards.
I thought the other thing that was actually interesting as well from the montage with Mickey was that Mickey's psychic. Mickey had a kind of assistant that was really hands-on as well. And
yeah.
He was, you know, he was always there.
Poking him in the stomach.
Oh, baiting him, yeah.
Lashing over.
But it's, you know, Mickey couldn't do that himself. And I suppose it's important as a coach that, like, I'm not saying to be able to show every skill, but if you want to show kids a skill, you have to be able to show them the skill. And it doesn't have to be you, but it can be somebody. It can be a different coach, or it can be somebody you just get to come down for the session. But if we're teaching a kid how to jab lift the ball or how to kick the ball over their hands, it's important that they can actually see it. So if you're
if you're stuck, just get one of the kids to do it for you. Call them, no?
Get the kid. I suppose what I'd recommend would be, if you don't have any coaches to do it, is get the best kid, because if the best kid can't do it, you shouldn't be doing that skill anyway, you know. So it's important to, I suppose, surround yourself with adequate assistance.
Yeah, I thought it was good. And you see, I don't know, did you notice from the first film, which I never noticed before, at the giving the orders on round 15 in Rocky 1 with some other guy who wasn't in Rocky 2 whatsoever, had the final words in him, so they got rid of him for Rocky 2.
At the end of the film, is it?
Just, he was actually through the whole way of Rocky, the original Rocky. He's in the corner. Last man. Yeah, and then they got a new fella in for the Rocky 2, so maybe just wasn't up to it. Got rid of him. Cut him.
Got rid of the weak link.
Got rid of the weak link. Rocky was like the Pied Piper of Philadelphia, wasn't he?
Ah, here. Look, though, the other thing on that, like, he was going fairly slow if all those kids were able to stay with him.
But he took off at one stage there.
Ah, but sure, that was camera angles.
I don't know. Thought he was all right. I don't get he was running a long time there now.
And the kids, running across the road, cars flying around. There was actually one scene. It was just kind of when he got to the end of the straight road, and before he got up the steps, he kind of went around a bit of a statue in the middle.
And
you could see the second and third kids. There's kind of a small little pillar, and they both went around it. And all I was thinking was just cycling. No, like, if that was
Peloton.
First one go around it, third one goes bang straight through it.
Yeah.
So I can guarantee you there was kids piled over in a pile up.
Carnage.
Ensuring that at some stage. Ah, guaranteed.
Carnage, yeah. Guaranteed. No, it was good. But there was, just when we're talking about Rocky's IQ level there, one of my favorite lines from the film was when he was going buying a new house, and it was, whatever it was, 2, 2, 3, whatever. He goes, oh, it's going to be lucky for me. That's up nearly to 9.
Oh, yeah. did the numbers add up to 9?
Nearly, he said. They nearly add up to 9.
What was that even about?
Yeah.
I suppose other things that from a training perspective, he'd him chasing a chicken. I suppose different training methods that he tried, he'd him chasing a chicken.
Like, I thought that training with the chicken thing was great. Like, I suppose, and it's maybe not as prevalent now as it used to be, but like, the idea of ladder work in Gaelic games doesn't really sit well with me, because that type of movement isn't what happens in the match. It's that kind of on the balls of your feet, moving right and left, reacting to a stimulus, which he was exposed to with the chasing of the chicken, which I thought was really good, you know. And like, you know, reaction balls with the kind of the six knobs coming out of them, they can be good for working on that change of direction, really. I liked when he had the left hand tied up, when he was just focusing solely on the right-handed jabbing and punching. And it was funny when he goes, I'm on 7 or 8. I don't know which one I was on. But,
493 to go.
Like, I think that building limitations into training sessions is important to get people to be able to hone their weaknesses, because, like, and I'm talking about, I suppose, working with kids primarily here because it's the easiest time to get it done, like working on them left side as much as possible, or right sides for the kid dogs or whatever, is really, really important, just to get that done and to praise them when they do activities with their weaker foot or whatever. So I remember years ago in the club, we used to have a thing called the doorknob of the year. And one year, this fella, nickname is Bambi, because he wouldn't be the most dexterous fella in the world. But he talked about like being two-sided one day. And he goes, I'm amphibious. And he ended up getting doorknob of the year because he said he was amphibious.
Very good.
2 foot of the ambidextrous.
Was it Rocky?
I don't know what you mean by that, Mussy.
Say IQ level similar, I'd imagine.
Ah, no. Smart enough. Well, smart enough. Certainly thinks he's smart enough anyway.
Very good. But if you want to go back there, right, and you can compare senior level football to senior level hurling, right? How many players at football can kick with both sides of your feet? Sorry, not both sides, with both feet. Compared to hurling, where if you can't strike on both sides, you're not going to be getting a game probably at junior level.
I'd imagine every senior footballer can kick with both legs. Now, how confidently they can kick is a different question.
Some senior footballers can't kick with any foot.
I think the quality of kicking left and right has really improved the last few years.
Absolutely, kicking has been fantastic, but are they off both feet though?
I don't know. I was trying to, like, I'm just thinking of the one of Dermot Connolly. No, I know Dermot Connolly's probably a bad example.
Think of all the elite players over the last X amount of years, 10, 15 years, they're all both footed players. The best of the best are.
Do you know what? I'll always remember there was one time when it was in a club on the north side of Dublin City, doing a workshop, and Kieran Kilkenny actually just happened to walk past. And I just asked Kieran, would he come in and say a few words to the coaches? You know, just, I think he was on the Dublin senior football panel at the time, maybe. And he came in, he said, and basically all he said is that my father said to me, if I want to play for Dublin, I have to be able to kick the ball as good off my left as I do off my right. And he said that's all he ever practiced. No, he obviously practiced, he'd blessed with a physicality and probably a brain. And a physical presence. And, you know, it's underestimated sometimes. But basic skills of him being able to kick the ball left and right competently is probably the reason that he's as good as he is. And if that's coming from one of the best players in the game currently is saying, kick left and right and be competent at that, like, I just can't understand why players don't do it more often. And I suppose one of the things you think it's simple, but like, if a player's going out training and they're there 20 minutes beforehand, all they're doing is kicking the ball over the bar to good leg.
Yeah.
And why aren't they, and I'm talking about elite now, I'm talking about senior, first teams, intermediate, whatever they are, teams with ambition. Why aren't every single one of those players working on their weak foot only in that time?
Yeah.
Because the coaches aren't getting them to do that. The coaches aren't using that time effectively. That's probably possibly... That time before training has the potential to be more important for their development than the actual training session. Because if they have a weakness and you know what their weakness is, you go, right, you know what? Mossy, come and train tonight. I want you to work on high ball for 15 minutes before we start. Or Colm, I want you to work on kicking the ball over the bar in this pocket of space here. You had the opportunity to do it 3 times at the weekend and you didn't do it. Before training, give them that opportunity to spend time doing things they're weak at. So Mossy, you at the weekend weren't good at catching high ball aerially. You were getting caught out in terms of your stance on the ground. Or Colm, you got a few opportunities to score, maybe in that kind of left-hand pocket out between the 45 and the 65, and you hit them all wide on the right-hand side or drop them short or whatever. Giving you the opportunity to work on that at training, pre-training, makes you aware that this is an area I need to improve on, but it also makes it aware that the coaches are acutely looking at your game to see where you're good, where you're not good. And then the next day out, you make improvements on that. You feel that personal sense of satisfaction. Hmm. Like purposeful training and purposeful practice is critical for individual development.
It's individual practice there as well, isn't it? In terms of telling you exactly what you have to improve on. It's not practice makes perfect. It's like perfect practice makes perfect, isn't it? It's just in terms of that. Like I remember reading something about what Ian Rush was saying in what I think was in his autobiography, or maybe I heard him saying it, but someone asked him, what do you do for training? He said, I used to practice all my weaknesses until the age of 30. Just practice on my left foot, practice whatever, shielding the ball, whatever it was. And then he says, anything over, when I got over the age of 30, I just keep practicing what I was good at. Because he wasn't going to develop that at that stage. I know. Can you improve at another age? You probably can. I'm sure you can. But he was just... That was just his theory. Like he says, practice my weaknesses. And then when he got to a certain age, you just have to practice what he was good at to keep him at that level.
Like if you go back to the right-handed and left-handed or right-footed and left-footed situation again. If you're driving a car and every time you get to a junction, you can't turn left, and you can only turn right or go straight on, you're limiting your options by 33%, you know? And if there's no option to go straight on and there's only the right-hand turn, you've only 50% chance of getting to where you want to go. And if I can't turn left and I want to get to Galway or I want to get to Cork, I'm not going to get there, you know? And it's the same in football or hurling.
Them towns are probably better off you not.
They don't want you down there.
Well, I'm not allowed to go down at the moment. Thanks be to God.
Thankfully.
There'd be no reason to be going down there. Whatever about Galway. Certainly be no reason to be going down to Cork.
I'd visit your family. Do you know what? One thing that I actually would have did one year with a team, just very, very poor in the year. And we actually, for about 3 weeks, we would have did 15 minutes. So we would have started at 7:30. We would have 7:15, special high ball session for whoever wants to come down. Now, every single fella came down, but it was just 15 minutes a night of just pure focus on the high ball. It was something the players and management kind of highlighted we were lacking in. But we did it before training session. Now, it kind of turned into a part of the training session, but no, it didn't in the fact that it was just a sole focus on that one skill. Kind of done, I won't say in isolation, but done with a high focus on that through activities.
In terms of when you get these people down to do their 15 minutes beforehand, what about the warm-up? Like I know not a lot of people, it's happened common where people come down, practice their kicking around and they pull a quad or something because they haven't warmed up properly.
Again, that's an individual responsibility for the player. And like this skill acquisition can be done building it up from, we'll say, 50% up, building it up each time they're doing it, so that they mightn't even get close to doing it at match pace, but it's the theory around it and building memory of how to execute an action is important.
Yeah, true.
Very good.
And you sound like a fella who was on the beer all day there. Your thing is brutal.
Yeah.
What?
Your connection is shocking. You're talking like Rocky. You're talking like Rocky.
Rocky, yeah.
You're talking like Rocky.
Right.
But anything? Just go back to one thing, just go back there about so comparing the hurlers to the footballers.
Yeah.
So like I think from a young age you're striking off your left side or right side, depending on your weaker side in hurling, like I say, from as soon as you can nearly strike the ball out of your hands, you're practicing from both sides. Where in football you don't. I think it's something that we should bring in a little bit more at a younger age. But again, name the best footballers. Name your favourite footballer of all time, Colm.
Martin Fitzgerald.
Yeah. both footed. Pork Joyce, both footed. Peter Cameron, both footed. Gooch, both footed. Jeremy Connolly, all the best.
Yeah. Like, I suppose, look.
Clifford. Look at Clifford now. All the greats, two footed.
Greats. You're putting them up on a pedestal, Massey. Nice and early. Yeah, look, I suppose, do you know.
Like, you're very good at hand passing at both hands.
I am, thanks. Cracks hard.
Yeah. Look, just simple. Just going straight, give them the eyes, left hand hand pass.
There's some simple exercise you can do to just practice with your other hand, and it works off. And it's just that split second that it pays off, rather than you have to just turn around and pop it off with your right hand. And it makes a big difference.
Right. Anything else to add on the film?
A couple of good lines there again in the film. Well, what, the one,
what,
the which was the one there.
My favorite was when he was tied, the arm tied, and he says, "Hey, Mick, I want to use my other arm." And Mick goes, "If you do, I'll chop it off."
Yeah. He will hurt you permanent.
Yeah.
And then the one from the Rocky one as well, he had it in the game about crap and thunder, wasn't it? Eat lightning and crap thunder.
Yeah. Paul, anything picked out for? No. Right, what are you giving Mickey out of five?
He got the W this time.
Okay.
He got the W, so he goes up a little bit further from whatever I got him the first day out.
What did I
give him the first day?
I have no idea.
I think you gave him 4.5.
No, I didn't give him 4.5. No way.
I think he only got one or two or something. It wasn't.
He was two. He was low enough.
Yeah, he was low.
No, I think it was a 2.83 or something like that.
Look, we'll give him a 3 then.
Okay, Massey.
No, we'll give him a 3.5. Look, he was innovative.
Go on, Massey.
Yeah, I can give him a 3.5 as well. He changed Rocky, as in terms of he knew he had to. Tactically, he had to change his style. He was working on his speed. He created a better bond with Rocky. And at the end of the day, he got the W.
Yeah, and I think there was much more of him in this film as opposed to the first one. So I'm going with a 3.5 as well. I suppose, I don't know, are we being unfair to the man? Like, he got the W. He was there by the fighter's side. Do you know what? I'm giving him a 4.
I'll give him a 4 as well. You're pulling on me heartstrings.
Massey, you saying 3.5?
Yeah, I'm solid.
Yeah, do you know what? He's not one for turning, Massey.
No
romance. One for turning.
No romance for that man. So yeah, look, I think it was a decent film. A decent film. Too much. It could be a 2, yeah. Yeah. So that's
another
it.
Thing about the film. Another thing about the film now that's sort of annoying me. The relationship between Rocky and Adrian was just ridiculous. For being a married couple, like, it was ridiculous. Like, they were teenagers.
Do you know what? I can't actually let it slide. The boxing scenes in it are the most unrealistic imaginable. Like, there wouldn't be that many punches landed in a boxer's career.
Yeah.
Never mind a fight over 45 minutes.
Well, the ref would have stopped it numerous times.
Yeah, I was watching it. In the sitting room, and my ma happened to walk in just when the fight was on, like, and the ewing and an out of her when, like, she didn't want Rocky to get bets. It was like fight back, and like, I'm there saying to her, "He's not even getting hit there. Stop, will you?"
We'll have to get sliced alone on the next day to defend the actions and the acting and the whole thing, the storyline. Any last things to add, Bossy? No, all good.
Yeah, looking forward to Rocky 3. Looking forward to the best Rocky film, 3 and 4.
Okay, we might do a double the next time with Rocky. Sure, they're separate coaches, are they?
There's about 3 different coaches in it. You have Rocky coaches in Rocky 4, and then he gets Apollo's coach.
Yeah.
And then in Rocky 3, you have Mickey and you have Apollo and his buddy.
Sorry, thanks, Massey.
Thanks, Cullum.
Thank you, Paul.
We might get to try to get Paul some broadband.
Yeah, we'll have to get an upgrade in broadband for next day. So thanks, everybody. And thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favorite platform. And if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Roy Orbison Tattoo. And we appreciate any likes, retweets, and comments. Next week, we will be watching Dodgeball. And we will have a special guest on with us. And we'll do a show available first thing Tuesday morning, as always. So be sure to join us. Thanks, everybody. Thank you.